Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today is a special man, a special dev, former designer at Bethesda, worked on The Elder Scrolls and Fallout, as well as the recent Starfield. He is now a novelist, enjoying semi-retirement, and he's just released his new novel, Glory Seeker Book One, Feast of Ghouls. I'd like to welcome the legend that is Bruce Nesmith. How you doing?
Hello, everyone.
How you doing? Things going well?
I'm doing great. I am doing great.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to start off with an interesting question, because when you rejoined Bethesda back in 2004, this is around about the time the Lord of the Rings films had come out. They were obviously massive in terms of fantasy. So I'm wanting to know if those films impacted the look and design of Elder Scrolls Oblivion, and maybe to a lesser extent, Skyrim.
They absolutely influenced Oblivion. In fact, Todd Howard will tell you quite candidly, he was looking to make a world that felt like you could be playing Lord of the Rings. You know, not necessarily with their actual lore, but the feel of it. So they had a big impact, and we were actually aiming squarely at what you would call traditional medieval fantasy with the Lord of the Rings flavor. And I think the team did a great job of that personally, but it's had a huge impact. And I love those movies.
Yeah, well, it looks like it did. So that's why I wanted to get clarification, because mm-hmm. I'm like, And, you know, for people who weren't around at the time, it was massive. It was a massive thing. It won, you know, all these Oscars. So you would think it would have a major ripple effect in terms of fantasy.
Oh, yeah. Well, and if you consider it, the Lord of the Rings books were actually instrumental in starting Dungeons & Dragons way back when.
That was right.
The seed of the whole fantasy construct that Gary Gygax wanted to emulate in the game. And that continued to be true as time marched forward through all the Dungeons & Dragons stuff. So it would not be an understatement to say that J.R.R. Tolkien is responsible for the vast majority of fantasy works that are out there right now. You know, he started it, he kicked it all off, and we've all just tried to add our little piece to it over time.
Mm. Yeah, makes sense. When you rejoined Bethesda in 2004, because you'd been out of the game industry for quite a while.
So 6 years.
6 years, yeah. Quite a while, and you weren't really up with what was going on anymore, were you? So were you kind of learning everything as you jumped back into Bethesda? And was it a bit overwhelming in terms of like, wow, okay, the way games are made has totally changed from, say, the Daggerfall days?
Right. Well, you have to remember that game development, video game development, like a lot of other fields, is one of those cases where you stand upon the shoulders of the people that came before.
Mm.
So while I had been missing a few years, I still had a lot of that foundational work underneath me. That said, the first, it's a long time ago, so I'm just going to guess 6 months, maybe longer, trying to figure out exactly how the editor worked, the construction set, and the spirit and nature of what we were trying to do with things. Yeah, it took a while. And later on, when I was a manager at Bethesda, one of the things that I said frequently and very much believed is it took at least a year for anyone on the design team to be able to do quality work without assistance. Doesn't mean they couldn't do quality work, but they would need help. Hey, how do I do this? You know, what's going on over here? But you'd need a year to master the tools and be able to do things independently. It's a very complex tool that they had. And there's a particular way of doing things that is, there's a lot of detail there. There's a lot of information.
Can it be quite daunting as a result, though? Or are you the type of person that's like,
it can be.
Just get stuck in there and be like, I got this.
Well, one of the benefits is that for the vast majority of the time I was there, the staff, the crew that I worked with, were a great bunch. One of the things that we were very, very fond of saying is that we valued the cooperative spirit and the egoless nature of things quite a bit at Bethesda. And it pays dividends because you can bring new people in and teach them this stuff. And it's not a matter of, you know, I have to be the boss, I have to be better, I have to, you know, have my ego on parade. No, it's just getting work done and doing quality stuff. And you celebrate somebody else being able to accomplish some of the things that you had to do on your own.
Hmm. Did you advocate to be lead designer on Skyrim, or was that a scenario where Todd was like, okay, I'm picking you?
Todd does all the choosing.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Todd does all the choosing. There's no applying for the job, as it were. Every time there's a project that comes up, Todd Howard decides who he wants to be based on past performance, based on what he thinks the project needs. You know, he selects who he thinks would be the best leader and the best person to lead that part of the effort. And, you know, I felt very fortunate that he decided that I was that person for Elder Scrolls V Skyrim.
What was your feeling when he told you this? Because I imagine he pulls you into a room and is like, hey, I want you to be the lead or co-lead.
Yeah. You know those moments in movies or TV shows where the character has something nice happen and they take it very calmly, then they shut the door and then they start pumping their fist in the air. And,
yep.
Yeah, that was me, yeah.
That was, oh, yeah. So you tried to play it off like, okay. And then...
Well, you're not going to jump up and down in front of your boss like
no,
that.
No.
At that point, he's like, maybe I made a mistake. I don't know if this guy can hold together. But, oh, yeah. No, it's elation. I mean, it was something that... from very shortly after I got to Bethesda, it was something that I very much wanted. And Todd knew that I wanted it. But the road to getting that is to do good work. Mm. And so that's what I did. I set myself to do good work and show that I could be a team player as well as a team leader.
So what's your relationship with Todd been over all these years? Because obviously in the Daggerfall days, you guys were kind of on the same level. You go away, you come back, and he's kind of moved up to the upper echelons of the company.
Correct.
And he pretty much become the PR face of the company as well.
He is. He is the face of the company. Pete Hines has made no bones of the fact that when he took over the marketing, Bethesda needed a face. They needed a person for the audience, for the customers, the fans to identify. Having an entire crew doesn't work well. You need someone who is, that's the guy. And Todd made a very natural choice for that. He's incredibly photogenic. He's amazing in person and on interviews and on the stage. And, you know, he was the boss of the dev team at that time. So he becomes that role. Mm. And initially, when I first joined with Oblivion, the team was very small. So we all knew each other very, very well. And there were a bunch of us that would go to lunch together, one of whom was Todd. You know, we'd play board games at lunch or just sit and chat. And then, you know, as time goes on, the team gets bigger, the responsibilities get heavier. There are many more demands on his time and what he can and can't do. And, you know, that slowly drifts away. And that's just a natural consequence of a studio that's growing and a director, you know, a game director who's got more and more he's responsible for.
Well, I have no idea how he manages his time. It doesn't even seem humanly possible, but he somehow finds a way to do it.
There are times we questioned that too.
his time and resource must be spread so thin.
It is. He wants to be able to have his hands in everything, but that's not humanly possible. So you end up with a situation where some things get very lightly touched, and then the things he cares mostly about, you know, he does a deep dive into. And by the way, I need to preface all this with saying that I've been away from the company for a few years now.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. like 3 years, I think it is now. So all this information is either from the days of Oblivion or during Skyrim or when I was working in that capacity. I'm not qualified to speak about the last few years.
Yeah, although I will say, I mean, he's still taking on a big burden, right? I mean, he's producing Indiana Jones game. He's got Elder Scrolls 6 and Starfield DLC and Fallout 76. And then there's the Fallout TV show. I mean, so...
He's always going to have his name on everything because he's the face of the company.
Yeah,
so right. So even in those endeavors where the touch is very, very light, it's going to be his name. And you know, as talented as he is, it's a mistake to think that any studio director is personally doing all the work on any project.
Of course,
that's just not realistic. You know, they're fortunate if they can have the time to even look at something a little bit and pass some judgment on it. Instead, the vast majority of them do what Todd did, which is pick and choose the things he cares most about, and then trust the rest of his staff to carry through on other things. And, you know, just deal with a really light touch on those other principles or work efforts and let his directors and his managers and his talented staff try and create the best product they can.
Yeah, well, I know in the early days or up until around about Starfield, you would be able to go to Todd directly to talk about something that needed to be resolved or something that needed to be implemented or whatever, right? And as time went on, that became increasingly difficult because his time was spread thin.
There are just too many projects.
Yeah.
I mean, when I first joined the company in 2004, as you pointed out, the only project going on really was Oblivion. I mean, the whole concept of DLC didn't even exist. Bethesda was one of the first to even do a DLC of any kind, you know, with the infamous horse armor DLC. But, you know, so that was the only project. You know, there were a few things that I'm sure you had to deal with in terms of reprints of things or foreign language translations of old products, stuff like that. But in terms of development, it was just Oblivion. You know, fast forward to 3 years ago when I left, he probably had 2 dozen projects that were on the table, some small, some large. You know, there's mobile games, there's remote things that he just has to, you know, take a look at, in addition to a variety of larger projects. So, you know, that's a lot.
It is a
lot. And the transition that you're talking about from him being extremely accessible to him being very difficult to access personally isn't something that happens overnight. That was years in the making. You know, so it starts with people who are in management positions or leadership positions have easier access, transitions to access to him has to go through them or is much less frequent. You have to schedule it way in advance, all that kind of stuff. And he tried very, very hard to be accessible for a very long time. You know, this isn't something that any manager wants to do, is to become less accessible. But when you've got 400 people under your belt, you know, what are you going to do? Spend 3/4 of the day talking to each of them that wants to talk to you?
It's not feasible.
Or do you have mid-level and higher-level managers who can take that responsibility and execute that for you so that you can get on with the more important work of directing the overall project?
It's interesting. When I spoke to Jonah, he said to me that the day when Todd rides off into the sunset, there's going to be a lot of stumbling and staggering within the company as to who can replace him.
Well, he's struggled throughout his entire career in this letting go process. I mean, if what I said earlier is, yeah, light touch on everything and then deep dives into the things he wanted. That's a light touch literally on everything, which means that one of the issues that the studio struggled with occasionally was, well, we can't move forward because Todd hasn't had a chance to look at it. Now, obviously, this wasn't something that was, you know, completely a blocker because the games got produced. I got produced on time.
Yeah.
Which is not a common thing to happen in the industry, to, you know, have it done excellently and have it done on time. But it does mean that when he leaves, they're going to feel it. But I could also name you a half a dozen other people that when they leave, the company's going to feel it. Maybe not to the level of Todd, but, you know, they're going to feel it.
Well, I feel like there's two sides to that, right? From an individual perspective, it's probably good because it gives you more power. You can probably demand more money, I think. But from a business perspective, it's bad because if that person leaves, then it puts the company in a bit of a down spiral until they're able to find someone who can effectively get the pipeline back in order.
Yeah. But I don't see him leaving anytime soon.
No, I don't. I don't see that either.
He's still fairly young and quite vital. And I think we have many, many more years before we have to worry ourselves with, you know, Todd Howard not making games.
No. But I suppose, I mean, I'm just thinking in terms of Elder Scrolls 6, the amount of pressure. And I know you've talked about this in previous interviews in terms of like the whole reality versus expectations.
Oh, I do an entire talk on it that I give at universities and other places. It's called The Game of Expectations. And I won't say famous, but I'm well known for parading that phrase out. It's the game that's played in real life, and it is one of the most important games you will ever play everywhere. You know, for that game development, everywhere, you are always judged by your expectations. One of the things that I do in my talks is I give a little bit of a scenario. You know, your five-year-old child comes to you and shows you a drawing, and it looks amazing. And he's like, oh, wow, this is really, really cool. And you put it up on the refrigerator, and you show your neighbors, look, my kid did this. Isn't that great? And they went off. If that same picture was given to you by a 30-year-old professional artist, you would start to wonder, what's going on here? Are they having a nervous breakdown? Is there an issue?
Yeah.
And it's the same picture. The picture has not changed. The only thing that's changed is your expectation based on who gave it to you. We almost never evaluate anything based on its absolute worth. It's always its relative worth. Even things that you consider hard currency, like gold or gems, it's their relative worth, that their expected value, that becomes its true value. So everywhere you look in life, you're being judged on your expectations. You are not being judged on the actual content. And that's difficult for some people to come across, to accept rather, when they come across it. But it's very, very true, is that you have to look at what the expectation is in all walks of life and all facets of things. At least that's what I believe.
But it's very difficult to control, though. Like with Elder Scrolls 6, the name alone just raises expectations. And because Skyrim was such a landmark in open world, and it was massive, and I don't know, it sold like 50 million units or whatever it did. But
and this is the problem that games that came after Skyrim had. You know, this is the problem that, you know, Fallout 4, Fallout 76, Starfield had, because you aren't always in charge of the expectations. You know, the 30-year-old who's making a piece of art, who's a professional artist, he can't control the expectation because he's got all this history. You know, it's there whether he likes it or not. And the same is true for the fans who want to buy Elder Scrolls 6. Their expectation is going to be almost impossible to meet. It's, you know, and marketing departments, you know, just put their head in their hands and weep at this, you know, because it's like, okay, if it isn't perfect, it just doesn't get a 95 plus on Metacritic, we're a failure. Excuse me?
Yeah.
Excuse me? But it's true. So they work really, really, really hard to manage expectations, to try and set expectations so that they're properly met by the team and by the people who buy the game. And Elder Scrolls 6 is undoubtedly going to be an amazing game. but it's going to be compared to all the previous games that Bethesda made, just like every studio's games are going to be compared to their previous products.
Well, imagine not even the just, I was just going to say, well, not even just their games, but other open world games as well, because when Skyrim came out, open worlds weren't the rage like they are now. I mean, they're everywhere now, to the point that it's almost derivative. And then you've got certain fantasy games that have come out, like Elden Ring, the two Zeldas, Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, that have moved the dial, raised the bar as well. So the amount of pressure, I feel sorry a bit for Todd and the devs in terms of trying to meet it.
It's the blessing and the curse. I mean, having that expectation also means that they are given the resources and they are given the what they need to try and make something amazing. But they're going to be judged. You know, imagine for a moment that you work at Larian Studios, you know, and they just released Baldur's Gate 3. And now they've got to make another game. What are the expectations going to be on that studio's next project? You know? And I'm going to say right now, Larian was not a studio that was uppermost on everybody's mind. You know, didn't fall off the lips of the vast majority of people buying video games. You know, they had a number of cool titles, and I can list a few of them for you, but they weren't what everybody considered to be a top tier publisher. Well, guess what? They are now.
Yeah, they've been put on the map now.
Yep, they're on the map now. And that means the expectations are sky high for them.
Yeah. So from a developer standpoint, do you try and just not look into that and try and almost develop tunnel vision and just focus on the task at hand?
You do. And it's made easier by the fact that you aren't in the marketing team. You are not constantly chatting with the fan base out there. You know, you have in front of you your team and the work that you have to do. And when we look at making sequels, speaking of talks, I do an entire talk about making sequels too. You're looking at a couple of different things. You have to look at what should I do the same, what should I do different, and what should I do new? And you have to have something significant in each of those buckets. If a sequel does not contain anything that's the same as the previous one, well, it's only tangentially an actual sequel. There are things about that previous game that people loved and they want to have again. You know, if we made, if Bethesda made a new Elder Scrolls games and it didn't have the material set that they were used to, that would probably disappoint most people. You know, the elven, the orcish, the Daedric, the glass, etc. That would be a disappointment. And then there's things that have to change. You look at the things that did not get received well. You know, in Fallout 4, the dialogue system where you had to choose one of the four directions, that didn't go over so well. You'll notice it got pulled out for subsequent projects. You know, Starfield didn't have that at the Skyrim style dialogue system. So you've got to know what to change as well. And then there's the something new. If you aren't putting something new on the table, it's kind of like, well, yeah, I played that already. So we had a number of things new in Skyrim, dragons being the number one thing, but also the whole Radiant story system where the world becomes highly responsive to the player's actions. And these are things that excite players. So you have to have all three of those buckets. You have, what do I keep? What do I throw away? And what do I add that was never there in the first place? And that's, if you can manage all three of those, you have a hit sequel.
Easier said than done, though.
Way easier said than done. Yeah. Way, 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 way easier.
And I suppose with Skyrim, there would have been stuff that ended up on the cutting room floor, so to speak. There would have been stuff that I assume you spend a lot of time on and then it gets tossed out.
Not as much as you would think. And well, that's good. That's one of the things the studio struggled with. You know, our internal line that we say while shaking our heads to each other was always, Bethesda never saw a feature, didn't want to add in the game. We are feature rich, and I keep saying we. Feature creep. I haven't been there for a while. It's just a habit. But you know, it's a feature rich game. But yeah, there are things that they have discussed, and you know, they don't end up in that. In Starfield, for example, I can tell you there was a whole building ship components from natural resources system that I had personally worked on. And there just wasn't room in the art schedule and the programming schedule, ways to make it work sufficiently with the design to put it in the game.
Mm.
So it's not in there, even though a significant amount of work went into it. And that's going to be true for a lot of games, you know? It's one of the things Bethesda keeps trying to get better at, is making decisions to throw things away or to not do something. Because they don't lack for content in their games. That's
no. Fair. You could spend a good decade playing just one of their games.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And people do and have.
Yeah. Because you're a novel writer, you've probably heard of the term writer's block, and I've spoken to writers mm-hmm. and musicians that have writer's block, and I'm not sure if you've had that with your novels, but is there such a thing as designer's block, where you're just having one of those days where nothing comes?
It can happen. It doesn't happen very often to me. I've been very fortunate in my career that I've been disciplined enough to forge ahead anyway and accept that, well, my personal peccadillo will be I have to throw away some work because I did it and it sucks, as opposed to I'm not doing anything because I refuse to move forward until I have the perfect thing. But I can also tell you that when I'm working on a quest, and this has always been personally frustrating to me, if I can't write the next line of dialogue for the character, I really struggle to move on. And I've been known to sit in front of my computer like this for 15 minutes trying to figure out what this character should say. And I'm willing to accept, you know, not a great line of dialogue that I'll come back and change later, but it's got to be an appropriate line of dialogue. I can't just put in, you know, character says something interesting here and move on. I'm not capable of doing that. And I'm sure other designers have their own personal things, but that's the big one for me, is that I can't just say, well, he goes out and does the next thing. I've got to write the line of dialogue or I can't proceed.
Would you say that you're hard-headed?
That I'm what?
Hard-headed, meaning like
hard-headed.
Yeah.
Probably somewhere between granite and ironwood. Yeah. Yeah. I can be difficult to move off of something that I believe in. And it's one of the areas of personal growth that I try very hard to do is to, I think I'm very good at listening with an open mind. I'm just not very persuadable sometimes. So that can be a challenge. And I try very, very hard to listen with an open mind and weigh the various things that people are offering. And Bethesda was very good for that, because Bethesda as a studio culture was very good at acknowledging other people's work. I don't think I can ever think of a time when somebody claimed credit for someone else's work. And in fact, they'd go out of the way to say, oh yeah, and this was so-and-so's idea, or, you know, I'm dovetailing off of what this other person did. And that makes it easier to avoid that that issue.
Well, I suppose the flip side in terms of good things about being hard-headed is you end up having perseverance and the mental fortitude, I suppose, to carry on when things seem hopeless. I mean, you've told a story, I think it was after 10th Planet, where you were fired and 6 months you were out of work and it was really bad. Your neighbors were bringing you peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Yeah.
Which is crazy, by the way. But obviously, I'm guessing at that point, you're at rock bottom. You're probably applying for jobs all the time.
Yeah.
Getting no replies, maybe rejection letters, and you still keep applying.
Yeah, now you have to. And anyone who has been out of work immediately discovers something that they may or may not have known before. And I've said this before in other talks. You don't realize exactly how much of your own self-identity is wrapped up in your job. And when you don't have one, the foundation under which you have supported yourself psychologically starts to crumble. It is a extremely difficult thing to stay up when you're not working. You know, if we don't, and I think this is, while not a uniquely American problem, it is definitely a little bit worse in countries like America, where we have a work hard culture.
You know, or live to work mentality.
We choose not to take vacations. We put in a lot of extra time. We are defined by our job to an unhealthy degree in a lot of ways. So that's, you know, that is a struggle. And, you know, being hard-headed, maybe that helped me find a new job.
Well, how was it? Was it difficult for you when you semi-retired, when you didn't have a job per se? Because did you feel like part of your identity was lost, or were you fine? Because it sounds like you're acutely aware of it, well, especially now. Maybe not at the time back then, but if you're aware of it, then obviously you can mitigate the problem.
Yeah. Yes and no. Because I was prepared for retirement, because it wasn't something that snuck up on me. You know, I'm 65 years old right now. I was 62 when I was. Pardon?
You don't look it. You look young.
Oh, thank you. I was 62 when I left Bethesda, and while that was slightly earlier than I had intended, it's something that you're preparing for when you get to this point in life. So it wasn't something that was just like, oh shit, what am I going to do? I don't know. These are thoughts that had already been going through my head. I had already been making plans. And in fact, I wrote my first novel, Mischief Maker, while I was still employed at Bethesda, as part of this is what I want to do when I retire. This will be my retirement gig. So it took me 2 years to write that because I could only work on it on the weekends. You know, these days I can knock out a novel in about 5 months, which is still, compared to some authors I know, super slow. You would not believe some of the stories. So I knew that's where I was headed. But once I did retire, it was also an acknowledgement of, I am not the kind of guy who's going to do well just sitting on the couch and watching Netflix all day. You know, that's not me. I can't do that. I need something, even if it's part-time. And I probably work at writing part-time. I could write a lot faster if I would do a little 8-hour day instead of the 4 to 5 hours a day that I spent into actually writing. You know, an acknowledgement of my self-awareness of what I need is I needed something that was creative, self-fulfilling, and had a small element of competition in it, competing with myself. Can I write something that other people want and enjoy? Because anybody can just write the novel, leave it in their computer, and, you know, hand printed copies to their friends or e-files to their friends. You know, to actually take the risk and put it out there and let total strangers read it and go, that takes a little bit of extra.
Yeah, well, I suppose usually creative people tend to be a bit more sensitive and have a bit more of an ego, so we're a bit more fragile when it comes to that stuff. But you've probably worked in the industry long enough to know that. You know, you can't take
I had my ego beaten out of me a long time ago. TSR probably did most of that work, but you know, Bethesda later on did the rest of it in a good way, by the way. Because in order to do good work, you need to be egoless, and you need to be in an environment that supports being egoless, because you can't do it all alone. You absolutely can't. You need other people's inputs, particularly on games that are as complex as things like an Elder Scrolls or a Fallout title. Those games are staggeringly complicated, and everybody's got to chip in. You've got to listen to them in order to be able to get good work done and get it in the game.
Mm. But I imagine the culture at Bethesda helps foster that. I mean, if you're working with a good team and you have a good culture, you have a good leader, that makes that stuff a whole lot easier. I mean, Bethesda had a high retention, a high retention rate for a very, very long time. It still does.
Up until, I'm going to say 5 years ago, since I'm not an HR guy, I don't have the exact metrics, but it's going to be roughly in there. The retention rate was staggeringly high. And in fact, it became an internal problem because when nobody leaves, there's no upward mobility.
No promotions.
There's no place to go to. You know, a certain amount of turnover is actually necessary for that to happen. And it just wasn't happening. People were staying there for, you know, decades. You know, I've got a 15-year, one of those plexiglass 15-year things up on my table up there. And there's a whole slew of them out there. There's a lot of people been with the company 10, 15, 20 years. It's a staggering achievement.
Oh, yeah, particularly in an industry known for layoffs, especially at the moment.
I have a friend of mine, Dave Cook, a.k.a. Zeb, who was the author of the second edition D&D books. You know, quite honestly, a far more notable and famous designer than I am. And he wasn't lucky enough to end up at Bethesda early in his career. And as a result, he ended up moving from one studio to another. They'd finish a project. The studio would either go out of business, would get sold. The next project didn't need his particular talents. Say, you know, it wasn't in fantasy and science fiction. It was something else. And so he just kept hopscotching. This is an immensely talented guy. He eventually landed at Elder Scrolls Online at the ZOS Studios, ZeniMax Online, where he did get to stay for quite a while until he retired. But I always look at his career to tell me there's a large amount of luck involved. And I've spoken on other podcasts, and I'll be more than happy to tell the story again if you want, about the outrageous luck that I've been fortunate enough to be blessed with in my career. Some stunningly lucky moments that got me to where I am now.
Yeah, and I think when you're worried about the security of your work or the place where you are working, it would inevitably hurt your work as well, because you'd have a bit of anxiety in the back of your head, like, well, what's going to happen once this project's done? Is it going to finish? Yep. Where am I going to go next? Yep. You know? So maybe the stability of Bethesda is, in a way, its superpower.
It helps. It definitely helps. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, success begets success. You know, that's the old adage as well. But if you look back at, I'll turn the clock back to post Fallout 4, the last four major projects that Bethesda Studios had released had all been Game of the Year. And not just a little Game of the Year, a huge Game of the Year. Like everybody's choice for the Game of the Year, you know? Metacritic scores in the mid to high 90s, you know? And there was a sense of infallibility that pervaded the studio because of that. And, you know, they could do no wrong. They had this secret sauce. They knew the formula to, you know, get the elixir of life, you know, throw in whatever metaphor you want here.
Yeah. And I suppose that came to a head with Fallout 76.
Yes, that's Fallout 76 was an awakening.
Which is a good thing. I think it's very easy to fall into the trap of, you know, getting cocky, I suppose, and thinking you're...
Well, good, bad, or indifferent, it was a necessary thing for the studio to refind itself. Something had to shake them up. Something had to wake them up. You know, I won't say complacency was what was going on, because it wasn't. It was the game of expectations I talked about before. There was an expectation that we would always find the way through the wilderness.
And when you were advised by a few people during Fallout 76 to not do it, right? That you'd bitten off more you can chew, weren't you?
Well, 76 was largely something Todd very much wanted to do. And there was a chorus of voices telling him, there were problems with the approach, that this was way more than it really looked like it was. But he had voices telling him the opposite as well, that no, we can pull this off. We know it's going to work. And he chose to listen to one set and not the other. And in my personal opinion, I think when you start hearing any substantive amount of voices saying something different, you have to listen to them. Even if you've got other people over here saying the opposite, just their mere existence in that volume means you need to sit up and pay attention. I remember not Todd, but a very highly placed member of the staff saying, we just thought you guys would be able to pull it all off, that it would just all come together. And that's that expectations thing, you know, because we had done it all the other times before. Why wasn't it happening now? You know, and the answer is it's not something you can take for granted. That in order to make a great game, it takes everything. It takes amazing leadership and direction and vision and hard work of the people that are executing on that and innovation and all those things. You miss any major block of that and you're going to miss. And in that particular case, and this is just my personal opinion, the leadership had fooled themselves into believing it could be done. And it didn't happen that way. Now, to give everyone due credit, they also decided as a leadership group that they were going to stick with that game and they were going to fix it and make it great. And today, Fall 76 is still out there. It's profitable. The company, to the best of my knowledge, has no plans to cancel it. And keep in mind, I'm 3 years out of date on that. it's a big success turnaround story that they took a game that a lot of people out there in the fan base were like, we don't like this. And they listened to them and turned it around and turned it into something that people wanted to play and made it successful.
Well, also, if you create something in isolation that might be average or it doesn't, blow everything out of the water, once you create a bit of a domino effect with other maybe iterations of that. So say with the Fallout TV show ended up causing a ripple effect where people went back and played Fallout 4 and Fallout 76.
I went back and played Fallout 4.
after watching the TV show.
After watching the TV show, I went back and played Fallout 4. And when I say I played it, beginning to end, I played every single quest.
Really?
Went to every location, played all the DLC. Yeah. No, it spurred that. I remember having fun doing that. Let's crank that up. And the game was still a blast and still tremendous fun.
So you enjoyed the TV show? I thought it was a great adaptation.
It was stunning. Yeah, no, it was fantastic. I think they got the spirit and the vibe. And they did the really smart thing of not trying to cross every T and dot every I to make it absolutely in match with the games. But they met and exceeded everyone's expectations, since we're talking a lot about expectations. It was a great adaptation of a video game. One of the better ones that I've seen, quite frankly.
One of the few ones, I would say.
Well, the other ones that don't succeed tend to sink beneath the waves without a lot of notice. So,
yeah. Well, I'll be honest. I had low expectations. I was reserved on it primarily because, other adaptations of video games haven't been the greatest. But I did
have
some optimism because Jonathan Nolan was involved, and he's a very good writer. And Todd was very protective. I mean, he'd been approached, I think, before for many years adapting Fallout. And he was against it until he found the right partner. And
yeah. Well, when you look at a project like that, that is not something that's going to make the gaming studio a lot of money. I mean, when you consider selling 25 million copies of a game and hauling in over $1 billion in raw cash, have expenses and all that, and then you look at what you're going to get in margins on a TV show. They just don't compare. So the amount of money the studio is going to get, that's not why you do that. The reason you do it is for the exposure. So Todd is 100% correct. You know, you don't want to just throw it out there because you're going to make a little bit of money. You want to put it out there to increase your exposure, to make the fans remember how wonderful things are. And they saw it, a huge explosion in people playing Fallout 4. And I'm going to guess, I'm not with them, that they had a lot of people buying DLC that hadn't bought it before. And, you know, Creation Club pieces and things like that. So, you know, I imagine that's where they made what money they made off of the show.
Mm. I'm sure they couldn't have predicted to what degree it would cause that effect, though. No, there's no way.
No. Todd's actually on record as saying he was really surprised at the sudden influx of Fallout 4 players. And I would be too in his shoes.
Yeah. Mm. And, well, he did have a hand in the show as well.
He did.
Not a big one, but he did play a role in it. I wanted to ask, in terms of design, do you ever... I mean, because I know you've done traveling. You've been to Europe. You've been to Singapore, various countries. Do you ever look at anything when you're out there in the wilderness and use that as inspiration when you're designing something?
Everything is inspiration. Everything. Every experience you have, you know. I go camping in West Virginia. There's probably something that works its way back in on caves or, you know, old trees or whatever it might happen to be.
Is it subconscious though, or can you be out, like, say, camping, and then you see something and that triggers something in your head?
For me, there's a lot of conscious moments. There are probably are subconscious ones as well, but the problem with subconscious moments is they're subconscious.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's definitely conscious moments. You know, some of the architecture you see in Singapore is just stunning, you know, and while none of it directly ended up in any game, I'm sure it impacted me in ways that you could probably find ties to in various pieces. So the whole idea of being a designer for the kinds of games that I was involved in is you are absolutely a jack of all trades. You have to know something about everything. You have to know history. You have to know psychology. You have to know science. The list just goes on and on and on and on if you want to do this kind of design work. Now, fortunately, there's many kinds of design work. Not everybody needs to have that, but I have to open myself up to all of it. So, you know, you open up a college course book and I know a little bit about just about everything that you would find in there. Certainly not an expert. So only in a few fields will I actually be able to do competent work at the college level on that. But I know something about everything. I know a little bit of history. I know a little bit about psychology. I know geology. I know physics. I know chemistry. I know sociology. I know anthropology. I know languages, linguistics. I know religion. I mean, I know a little bit about all of that. And that's, you know, the same thing with traveling. All of those moments when you get out and you get new experiences, meet new people, see new ways of the human, the way the human condition expresses itself, that all gets wrapped in. It all gets wrapped in somewhere.
I think you are a bit of an anomaly in that case, though. I mean, and particularly when you talk about game development as well, because you're from the old guard where the studios were so small that you would get exposed to everything. I mean, some of these big AAA studios, they're so big and vast in terms of their team size that some of them get isolated to just one role, right? Like one, so an animator would just focus on animation, an artist just focuses on art. You know, there's never going to be like cross-pollination between, say, a programmer and an artist necessarily.
Well, and also the role-playing game genre also does that, because in order to write those kinds of good stories, you need to have that depth of experience because you draw on it. You know, you have to remember that the same people who wrote adventures for Skyrim wrote adventures for Fallout and for Starfield. That means they needed to understand fantasy tropes and the whole medieval thing, as well as the kind of science that goes into post-apocalyptic, as well as the kind of science and world building that goes into Starfield. That's the same staff. Those are the same people. They didn't throw out the fantasy guys and bring in science fiction guys. So all those designers, you know, they have to be, like I kind of described myself, they have to have a bit of the master of jack of all trades kind of thing. Now, to the first part of your point, with studio sizes so large, yes, everybody tends to get very specialized. And those of us like myself who are old guard retain more of that. Although I'm going to argue it's not universal. But at Bethesda, there were quest designers and level designers and system designers. And that's Bethesda. The quest designer is kind of a unique role that you see in Bethesda that you don't see in many other studios. The level designers or gameplay designers are very common. Systems designers are very common, even though there's far fewer of them than there are the others. So people tend to get put into that. But, you know, let's take a look at a moment for a gameplay or a level designer, someone who makes the environment in which gameplay happens. In a fantasy world, they need to be able to understand the whole medieval and high fantasy aspect in order to create that properly. And then we move to Fallout. They need to be able to do the same for a rundown building. Okay, what makes a building a building? What makes it an office building versus a shopping center? What? How does something fall apart so that it feels appropriate that it fell apart this way? You know, okay, now let's go into space. Well, okay, what makes a spaceship feel like a spaceship? An alien planet feel like an alien planet? So even with those narrow disciplines, you still get some of this coming through when your studio goes through the different genres like that. Now, if you have a studio that doesn't, I'll pick on the Assassin's Creed guys for a moment. Well, actually, no, that's a bad example because they go to all those cultural places. But there are studios who have a narrow mission, smaller, and they stick within something. You're probably not going to get the same breadth of experience there because of the studio's limitations and what they do.
Yeah.
But yeah, in my career, I have done level design, quest design, system design. I've done programming. Everything. everything except the art.
Yes.
You know, stick figures, I'm still working on that. I hope to create a stick figure that is actually acceptable to an audience sometime in the near future. But otherwise, you know, I've even done the audio. You know, I've done just about everything. And that is passingly rare. That is, you know, people of my generation are the ones who are still going to have that aspect of those who work in extremely small independent studios.
Mm. Now, we do have to talk a little bit about your novel, Glory Seeker Book One, Feast of Ghouls. Tell me the genesis of this, what it's about, how long it took you to write.
It took about 5 months.
Pretty good.
It's a lit RPG book, and lit RPG is a relatively new genre. 20 years ago, I'm guessing here because I don't have the pieces in front of me to be highly accurate. 20 years ago, it didn't exist. I'm guessing it started around 15 years ago. And the idea there is kind of a Ready Player One thing where the main characters are living in a world that is governed by the rules of a video game or a tabletop role-playing game. And these rules are like smacking you in the face. You know, when you get hurt, you actually see your health bar go down. But you're a real living, breathing human being in this world. And it started off as sort of you end up in a virtual reality simulation. And in the intervening decade, it kind of has exploded all kinds of different rationales for how you ended up in a world where game rules are real. And so it's a combination of two things that I already had a history with, that I felt I had some expertise with. It's a combination of gaming, which I obviously have a very long history with, and novel writing, which I was relatively new to, but I did have an entire fantasy trilogy under my belt. And so I was like, I think I could do something really fun here. And so I said, let's see if I can do this. And so I set myself out to write one with the idea that, okay, if this turns out to be something I'm not enjoying, we'll go back to writing the regular stuff. And I managed to get an entire book done, and I enjoyed the process. And then I had to start going through the long, tedious process of finding a publisher. Because one of the things I decided with my first set of books and with this book also is I don't want to be one of those self-published guys who has to do it all. I want to enjoy the writing process. You know, you can have some of my money if you'll take care of the rest of it for me.
Yeah, fair enough.
That's the price I'm willing to pay. I'm not in it for the money anyway. You know, independent books, you know, they make enough to take the family out to dinner a couple times. You know, it's it's not quite that bad, but that's the line I give everyone. And so Lit RPG started to become something I was very much enjoying. And I finally did find a publisher. And by that time, I had three books done and was starting to work on number four. And so Aethon Books has been gracious enough to agree to publish my works. And so I've been working with them for the last many months, taking care of everything that needs to be taken care of in order to publish a book, things like editing and getting a cover and all that kind of stuff. And it finally released today, you know, August 13th. It's actually able to purchase. So this is, you know, this is a milestone day for me in two ways. I get to do a fun podcast and I have released a book. I spent the first half of the day putting up promotional materials on, you know, Reddit and Facebook and things like that. So hopefully it gets well received. It's a little too early to tell right now, but Aethon is doing a fantastic job of promoting it. You know, hats off to Rhett Bruno over there and all his team. So I've got my fingers crossed, and anybody who decides to take a chance on it, I hope you enjoy what you read.
Hmm. What's the hardest thing you think about writing a novel?
For me or for everybody else? Because those might be two different answers.
Well, for you, I mean, you are an anomaly anyway. So we need to get into the mind of Bruce here.
One of the things that a very long career in creating content has given me is the discipline to be able to sit down and let things happen. We talked about writer's block earlier. It's not something I suffer from, really. Once in a blue moon, it'll happen. But for me, if I sit down and I start writing something, it flows. It may not flow as fast as I'd like. The quality may not be there. It may come rip it out later, but at least it flows. And that's a huge thing. So for me, sometimes the hardest thing is to connect the beginning and the end. Novel writers talk about being pantsers and plotters. Do you plot your entire book out and then write it? Or do you just sit down and words start to come to you and the story takes you wherever it takes you and you figure out where it's going? And I like to say these days that I'm between those two. I'm a plantser. So I've got one foot firmly in both. In order for me to write a book, I need to know how it begins and I need to know how it ends, because I have to be aiming towards something. And sometimes you end up meandering. And it's like, oh, how the heck am I going to get over there? I know where I'm aiming, but how am I getting over there? And that's probably the struggle I have, that I have to sit back and I have to do a little bit of planning and plotting and figure out how I'm going to get from where I am, assuming I like where I am, in order to get there. If I don't like where I am, well, then that chapter or two gets ripped out and I go back to where I did like where I was and work it through. So for me, that's probably the thing that's most difficult. For a lot of writers, it's just getting the next word down on the page, because they can fall prey to what I discussed earlier with my dialogue, where it's like, if it's not the right word, I can't continue. I just can't. And in novel writing, I have that problem with character and place names. I can't continue until I have the right character or place name. Fortunately, I'm very, very used to coming up with character and place names, and I have a whole process for how I go about doing that, so it doesn't slow me down much. But if I'm about to write something, I'm introducing a character, if I don't have that name, not another word ends up on the page until I have that name. I may change it later, but I got to have it.
Well, you've been doing it long enough now that that's your process, and it obviously works for you. Oh, so yeah. if it's yeah. not broke, don't fix it. Yeah.
Well, so far it's not broken.
Yeah.
So far it's not broken.
Hmm. Before we wrap up, there's a couple of people from the community that asked some questions. So I thought I'd just quickly.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Okay. So we have one here from Jonathan, 1988. What were some of the most challenging aspects of Starfield that took some additional time to resolve, overcome, or figure out? Do you recall anything while you were there?
There's the project, and then there's my work on it. For the project, it was definitely how to fill the planets. And if you read the criticisms, they only partially succeeded on that. But that was definitely the hard thing to do. Is there's a lot of empty planets out there, and you got to have something for players to do on them. And to be fair, there's plenty to do on them. It just isn't what the players were hoping to have to do on them. That was the disconnect there. For me personally, it was trying to restrain myself from over-designing. This is something that systems designers, which is what I spent most of my career doing, always suffer from. You over-design. Things get to be too detailed, too sophisticated, and you just have to keep stepping back. And because we weren't working with existing IP, i.e. Fallout or Elder Scrolls, it becomes a lot easier to do it. When you have a previous game that's been successful, you have kind of guardrails and you know where to stop.
You've got constraints. Yeah.
But with Starfield, it's like, oh, I can completely and utterly model this to the nth. No.
Dial it in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Second one here from Levi Khan. What were some of the differences in design philosophy moving from Fallout 4 to Starfield? How does he feel about the criticisms of the game? Are they fair?
I'll answer that last one first. I do think the criticisms of the game were fair. Some of them were brought to management while we were in process, but unlike 76, management acknowledged them, but sometimes you're kind of stuck. You have deadlines and you just have to do something and it's too late to make the counter reactions you need to make. So you try to do the best you can with what you have. And I think they ended up in some of that territory. And I'm going to ask you to refresh the first part of that question.
What were some of the differences in design philosophy moving from Fallout 4 to Starfield?
One of the big ones, I think, was humor. There is humor in Starfield. There should be humor in Starfield.
Yes.
But humor is a centerpiece in Fallout. The ridiculous is a centerpiece in Fallout, whereas it's frosting in Starfield. It's not the cake. So that's definitely something. Also, the science. We wanted the science to feel like it had a realistic foundation in Starfield. You know, yeah, there's stuff that's not realistic that's out there, but you have to look below the first level or two in order to say, oh, that's not right. Whereas with Fallout, it's like, let's ignore real science. We're viewing science the way bad 1950s movies and books viewed it. And that's what we want, and we want to push that into the player's face, because there's a silliness to that and a wonder to it that gives it a little bit of the science fantasy edge that makes Fallout what Fallout is.
Hmm. And the TV show nailed it as well, I think, as well.
They did. They absolutely did.
Hmm.
Yeah, one of my favorite scenes was, they inject dog meat with a stim pack and boom, a dog who's almost dead is standing up.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the way. That's what silly science works, you know?
Yep, that's right. And final question from Nerve RC. What are some cool features that they wanted the player to be able to do but ended up being cut? They haven't specifically stated what game here, so I'm going to give you an open-ended question to answer with whatever game you want to.
I'm going to go with a Fallout and a Starfield answer. In Starfield, it's the thing I already mentioned. We wanted to have a complete set of being able to mine materials, send them to a factory on automated another world that would then build spaceship modules that you could then build your own spaceship with. We wanted to have an entire economy working with that as its foundation. And so it'd be kind of a little bit of a strategy game or a resource manager game on top of a role-playing game. But it was just too much. You know, not that nobody liked that idea. It was just too much. And it had to be pulled out. With Fallout, and this has been talked about before, there was underwater gameplay, which, by the way, you'll notice is also not in Starfield. There was a huge shoreline in Fallout 4 and also one in Fallout 3, and all kinds of cool stuff that could have been done underwater. But the extra programming time, the art time, and design time in order to add that, it just was, you know, that was a line in the sand that was drawn and said, no, you know, we have to do the minimum to make water work and be what we want it to be. And everything else has to go away because we need to get the rest of this game working and working to a high level.
Yeah.
So.
And underwater physics and mechanics, I think, are quite hard to do anyway, aren't they?
There's easy and hard ways to do it. And if you play the game, you'll see the easy way to do it. Basically, you're not allowed to have combat, and movement is just literally up and down and forward and back and side to side. But, you know, you've also got to fill that space with art, which means you have to A, create the art that's going to get placed, and B, drop it into the world. That's a lot of effort. It takes a lot of staff to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and then if you want to have things working like combat, you know, now that's programming effort. You know, well, you're not just going to have nothing going on there. We need to create creatures that are underwater that function. That's more art. That's more programming. That's design. You're going to have quests that are happening. I mean, it just snowballs. It becomes its own thing. And in a game that's already incredibly rich with features, that's just a bridge too far. So, yeah. You know, it had to go.
Mm. Well, Bruce, I will wrap up there. Thank you so much for sparing me some of your precious semi-retirement time.
No problem. I'm glad to do it. I enjoyed myself, as you could probably tell.
Yeah. I'm glad you did. All the best with the novel.
Well, thank you.
I suppose it's available on Amazon and all good.
On Amazon. That's where you should go to get it.
Yeah.
Amazon and Audible. There is an audiobook version of it also for people who prefer that that method of consuming their novels.
Yeah. I'll have to touch base with you in a few months to see how well it's done. I'll be interested.
Absolutely. I'll be interested to know. I'm glad to talk again.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.